Carol Van Strum, welcome to Planet Waves AM FM on Radio Kingston.
Thank you.
So,
and birds.
Yes, Carol, and who are your birds, Carol?
That's Noah that you just heard, and the one that chitters away a little bit more is Archie. He's, I don't know if you can hear him.
Yes, he's, I actually can.
He's sitting in back of me.
All right. So you were in Berkeley in 1964 for the free speech movement.
Right. That's right.
That's amazing.
Well, no, it isn't, really.
Well, in terms of just being a witness to history, in my opinion, and you owned a bookstore, is my understanding?
Right. Well, we co-owned it, Cody's Books. It was a pretty famous place in its time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we built it, as a matter of fact. So, yes.
And
it was in the middle of everything because it was right on Telegraph Avenue, and that's where everything happened.
Right. So what is this thing? Now, remember, we're talking to the younger generations here. What was this thing called the free speech movement in the year 1964?
Well, it's hard to explain without, because there's really kind of a continuum here that we're talking about. That started, you know, probably with the Cold War, the Korean War. Then, you know, we had the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, there were all these events that conspired to make people feel threatened and helpless. And on top of that, the whole civil rights movement was happening during those same years leading up to 64. So, and a lot of the same people were involved. Some of the people on campus in 64 at Berkeley had been freedom riders. They had been part of that whole civil rights movement in the South. So I think it was, things just came to a head. The university had a policy where they did not allow any political speech or activity on campus. And people objected to that because actually it seemed to the students, I think, that they were allowing their kind of political speech, but nobody else's. Do you know what I mean?
Sure. And so this famous red brick plaza was considered part of the city of Berkeley, not the campus, and therefore...
It was part of the campus, but it was the part that... Okay. Telegraph Avenue led right into that that area of the campus. There were campus gates at the end of Telegraph Avenue, and you walked through them, and you were on campus.
Yep.
So everything spilled out onto Telegraph Avenue or began there and moved on into the campus.
Right. So, but from a documentary I saw today, The implication was that permission to use the red brick area was initially negotiated with the city or considered under the city's control, but then the campus claimed that plaza and kicked everyone out.
Well, I don't remember that part of it specifically. I just remember that the issue that actually triggered events was the university kicking everyone out and saying, no, you can't talk here, you know, about anything, you know, civil rights or war or anything.
In this little free speech zone that had established itself outside the gates.
No, it was basically inside. I think it was inside the gates, but there was so much spillover. Yeah. Anyway. That was the beginning of it, and a graduate student named Mario Savio. You got to remember, I was in the middle of it, but I never felt part of it. I don't know how to put this.
Sure, well, you mean you owned a bookstore a little bit up
well,
the street,
and I
right?
Was, yeah, and I was pretty young, and I knew all these people, and I liked them, but I never felt like I was, you know, an activist. I don't know what you called it then.
Right.
But because I used to babysit for Mario Savio's little boy who was autistic. So, I mean, I knew these folks, but I knew them as people more than as agitators, whatever you want to call them.
Right.
And, yeah, and he something set him off, and he stood up. I can't remember whether it was on top of a vehicle or a statue or something, and he just let the university have it, and people just flocked around him. He was a great speaker, and what he said resonated with the students, and that was really the beginning of it all. If you saw a documentary, it's probably more accurate than my memory, so I'm not...
Yeah,
it
was a
police
car, and the one of the things considered the symbolic thing was how everyone who spoke on top of the police car took off their shoes so that they wouldn't damage it.
Uh-huh.
And you know, this one documentary I saw today was describing this as a kind of the perfect symbol for the relationship between the activists and the police, one of respect, but not exactly going in the other direction.
Oh, yeah. The police at that time were... they were very anti-student. And I'm not sure what the basis of that was. I mean, but there was a lot of racism involved as well. Okay, here's an incident that I was right there for, and it happened right in front of us on Telegraph Avenue. We had a wonderful friend whose name was Gaylord. He was black. He was also very large and very strong, but he was one of those people that, you know, just was the gentlest person you've ever met. But he was waiting to cross the street, and cop car came and parked with its wheel right on his foot. And the cop knew what he was doing. Anyway, Gaylord tapped on the window and very politely said, "Excuse me, but you're parked on my foot." And the police inside just laughed at him and gunned the motor but didn't move. And so Gaylord just very politely lifted up the whole end of the police car and moved it over 4 inches.
You're kidding.
And they all they jumped out and arrested him. It was because he assaulted the police car. I mean, but there were so many people on the street, like hundreds of people followed that police car that had him in the back in handcuffs to the police station. Hundreds of people, and just crowded the police station, offering themselves as witnesses to what happened. And I think, I can't remember the outcome, except that they had to drop any charges.
you would think.
Yeah, because no one was going to go away. And that was the mood at that time, was that people did feel, the students felt, young people felt, very much in an us or them situation. You know, they were already, you know, getting drafted. They were, I can't remember the exact timing, but definitely people were getting drafted into the military at that time, whether they wanted to or not. And all these things were happening in the world and at home that were out of their control. I think it just came to a head.
Right.
And I think that's what's happening now. I mean, at that time, maybe it was more, I'm not sure how unique it was, but it certainly seemed to be, and I suspect television had a lot to do with it, because you have to realize this was only a decade after network television managed to get to the West Coast.
Yes, television was new in 1964, relatively speaking.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was bringing a world to people that was very, in a visceral way that radio and print media never did. And I can't explain that, but I think it's definitely true. And certainly what was coming, the news coming out of places. Oh, God, yeah.
Well, it was constant. I'm old enough to remember the coverage of the Vietnam War because my dad was a grad student studying media.
Uh-huh.
And so we would watch the news every night as part of his homework.
Right.
And I remember he had the microphone taped onto the speaker on the side of the TV. There weren't VCRs, and you couldn't like TiVo it, whatever it's called. And so he would just make a little reel-to-reel audio tape of the news. I have no idea what happened to those tapes. He has everything he ever bought, but not those tapes. And so I watched this. I remember like every night it would be, from Phnom Penh, this is so-and-so for NBC News.
Uh-huh.
It was all being reported from Cambodia often. Maybe that was the era of Cambodia that I was watching.
Very possible. Very possible.
So, and then the draft, I think, was, radicalizing because, you look at all these high school seniors, these 18-year-old kids, basically.
That's
and
right.
They were going straight to Vietnam if they were not going to college, and if they were moderately, physically fit, they were going to Vietnam.
That's right.
And so this focused attention and anger?
Oh, I think definitely, because, it wasn't just the ones that were being shipped over to Vietnam. They had families. They had brothers and sisters. And those folks were outraged. And they were the age group we're talking about here. That just, they found a way to get heard. And that was through things like mass demonstrations, walkouts, or whatever. And I'm, bless them for it, hard as it was for all of them, for all of us. Because our bookstore was tear gassed. We had the whole front windows were broken in by the National Guard.
Why did the National Guard break the windows of your bookstore?
Oh, they were convinced, and actually they were right, but we never let them know that there were people, activists hiding out in the back room, which is true, because we were offering shelter to people. I mean, they were getting tear gassed. They were getting shot at. I mean, it was just awful. And, that's the same period when the whole Black Power movement was happening, which was an outcome of the Civil Rights Movement. So some of those folks were also involved. I mean, and they they would all end up in the bookstore, put it that way.
Right.
And, we had our, even our home, our mailbox got blown up. I mean, that's stupid, but it's scary when it's right there in front of you. And it's, it's like a message saying you're next.
Yep. So I'm trying to imagine this scenario where there's basically war in the streets.
Yes. That's what it was. That's what it was.
And it was war in the streets of the government and its officials, and backed by university officials and Reagan, who was governor.
He wasn't governor yet. Who was it? Pat Brown, I think. But, because Reagan, I don't think he was governor until 67. I mean, not that things weren't all still going on then. They sure were. Mm-hmm. But at least in 64, when this first blew up, he was not the governor.
He might have been
the chancellor, I think. And I could be wrong here. Someone should look it up. Because he was the chancellor of the university system at that point.
He becomes governor on January 2nd, 1967. He was president of the Screen Actors Guild from 59 and 60. So I don't think he was the chancellor of the university. He was coming out of an acting career, and then he becomes governor, and he's governor from 67 to 75.
Yeah, I know that. It's just, it seemed to me he was involved, though, somehow with the university, board of something or others. But I could be wrong. But that's my memory.
Right. Because who orders in 64, there's an episode where the students are subjected to a chemical attack.
Yeah. That was including in our bookstore.
No, I mean like airplanes came and gassed the crowd.
Yeah, that I can't answer to because all I know is that they had helicopters that were landing right behind where we lived, and I didn't know what they were doing. Right. But they were throwing tear gas canisters all over the place or shooting them because that's what they got the bookstore with. It poisoned all the books. They had to get rid of everything.
Right.
As well as everyone who worked there.
So things have been more tense, well, more out of hand than they are now. I would say that there's similar tension in the air now, though it's mostly not rising to the surface yet.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think you have to remember, again, that background of, especially of things like the civil rights movement, where finally, who was it, Malcolm X or somebody was saying, you know what, we can't put up with this anymore. If they shoot first, we shoot back. Or it was something like that. I remember he gave a speech, was it to Congress, where he said, you know, bullets or ballots, take your pick. And it was like, yeah, because otherwise we're sitting ducks. We're getting lynched, we're getting shot, we're getting beat up, we're getting killed, including our kids. And it's got to stop. And I think people are getting to that point now, but I don't think they're there yet. But I think that was definitely part of what was underlying the mood of the students at that time.
Right. In my experience with student administrators, with the exceptions of with some exceptions, they tend to be extremely controlling of what they think students should think and say.
Oh, absolutely. They feel totally, honest to God, they feel totally threatened by, number one, any sign of intelligence in students or independent thinking. I mean, that's absolutely taboo to an administrator because, number one, you don't get to be an administrator if you are very intelligent, frankly. I mean, that's just the way it is, you know? And so they're very threatened by that. And they're very threatened by any sign of what they consider insurrection. I don't know there's probably another word for it, but school administrators are very, very similar to prison wardens. They want everything under control, and anything that smacks of escaping their control, they're going to stamp down on it very heavily. And I've seen it over and over and over again, both in prisons, and in schools.
Right. This similar mentality. And now the schools are pretty much populated by a police force. At Kingston High School, there were quite a few police officers in the building that day.
Uh-huh. Yeah, isn't that amazing?
I mean, I'm wondering what they're for. I mean, I'm wondering what the thought behind it is. Is it to intimidate, or do they really think there's going to be a riot? And even if there is a riot, let's say there's three or four guards in the school. It would seem to me to be a kind of posturing.
Oh, it's definitely that, and I think it stems from very, very deep fear on the part of administrators and probably a lot of teachers. I mean, I've known some very wonderful teachers, so I'm not going to paint them all with this brush. But there are quite a few teachers that side with the administrators and look on the students as them, as the other.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yep. As the basically as the inmates.
Yes. And so they have to be kept under control, and you call in the police to, you know, try to intimidate them into staying under control. And yes, you can call it something else and say it's to protect the students, but I haven't, if it's ever happened that any police in a school have stopped violence or school shootings, I haven't heard about it. Have you?
No, I did hear of an assistant principal who managed to wrestle a gun away from a kid. But, you know, at Parkland, at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, the resources officer remained outside. And we've heard
yep.
a number of news reports of several other police who came to the scene who remained outside.
Yeah.
What's your take on why the police aren't more resistant to people having the kinds of weapons that were used at Douglas High School? You would think the police would be the last people who want, nuts to have AR-15s.
You know, I don't know enough policemen. The few policemen I've known personally would be the first ones to say no one should have those weapons except the military, and maybe they shouldn't have them either. But so I can't answer that one. I don't know. I don't know why there isn't more police resistance to private individuals, civilian individuals owning weapons that are designed only to kill other people. They are not for hunting. They are not for any other purpose. They're to kill people. And that's amazing to me that the police, you know, maybe they've been brainwashed too. I don't know.
Yeah, it would seem that way. I don't understand it personally, and I'm taking any chance I can to ask people, in particularly in leadership in law enforcement, why they think that is. I wrote to the Saugerties police chief the other day and asked him, just because I was in correspondence with him, and I thought I would ask him. And I was quite surprised, actually, to see an eloquent statement that he believed that these weapons should be controlled, and that that people shouldn't have things like AR-15s, and that there should be testing similar to what police officers get for when people want a weapon. You should go through psychological evaluation in addition to a background check.
Well, see, that's what I mean. And there's your policeman.
That's one.
Giving you that answer.
And then another one I know is fond of saying that it wouldn't make a difference anyway, and this is a common answer that's given, it wouldn't make a difference. And the thing is that no one knows, because at least in the United States it hasn't been tried. In other places where it has been tried, it has made a difference.
That's right. I mean, I think one reason maybe they feel that it's futile is that there are so many of those weapons out there now. How would they ever even collect them all? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and most crimes are committed with new weapons, though.
Uh-huh.
As far as I can see, I've been tracking this, and so far I haven't heard of any that were not committed with relatively newly purchased weapons.
Uh-huh. Okay. So there... you know, there are no mass shootings with muskets. Okay.
Right.
Jesus.
So what would you say to today's students, you know, if you had to give them a message from, as a witness to other, let's say, moments of awakening?
Well, I tend to side with the students, number one, and their safety in numbers, guys. Keep doing it. Keep speaking up. And do everything you can to have your voices heard, because that's the only way change ever happens.
Yep. And I believe it makes a difference.
It does. It does. I know it does, at least in terms, look what happened with that free speech movement, which morphed into, you know, the whole anti-war movement. But it was all, it's all part of a continuum. Mm-hmm. The civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, it all goes together. And it's so important. It is so important.
Yeah, to keep the connection, I think, from one phase to another and from one generation to another.
And exactly.
And to know history.
That's the other big one. And not history the way it's being taught in your schools.
Mm-hmm.
No. yeah.
Well, Carol, thank you very much for giving us a little bit of a window here and some ideas.
Well, I hope so. I wish I could tell you more, but it was 60 years ago. How much do I remember?
It was 54 years ago. That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I don't want to even mention how old that makes me, so we won't.
Well, you're under 100, so.
Hey, thank you. Yes.
So that makes you a spring chicken. All right. Once again, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Oh,
okay.
You're most welcome.